You are listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to westhill.net/donate.
Good morning. It's a beautiful, beautiful spring morning, isn't it? With the magnolias coming out and the cherry blossoms. What a treat. As we begin our service today, though, could we first take a moment and acknowledge that we're on the traditional territory of the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nation, whose lands have been previously occupied by the Huron-Wendat and Seneca First Nations, which are part of the Williams Treaty of 1923.
Good morning, West Hill. Happy long weekend. How many of you are Game of Thrones fans? Anybody? I'm not. Never watched a show. But apparently it's like the big thing this weekend is it's the last Game of Thrones episode on TV. And people are so upset about this that they're making counseling available. So I'm not even joking. It's like £25, like... So what is that, $50 or something for half an hour of counseling? And so you just phone in, and it will help you digest your feelings and interpretation of the show, which could range from anger and confusion to sadness and grief. And so my point is that even when it's a TV show, when things are sad, we grieve. Oh, no. I want to share with you a newer concept that I've been coming across, and it's called solastalgia. Have you heard of this? Solastalgia. You know nostalgia. Nostalgia is like a longing for the past, right? When you're separated from separated from a home you love is nostalgia. Solastalgia.
I'm not going to read it.
You're not going to read it. Oh, you're just going to make me cry more. Rob knows when I'm crying. Don't hug her. She'll just cry more. She'll cry more. The reason I'm sharing it with you is because I'm experiencing it, right? So that's why I'm sharing it. So the medical journal, The Lancet, in 2015, included solastalgia as a contributing concept to the impact of climate change on human health and well-being. And so the idea is that it's like the same thing as nostalgia, but instead of a home you're separated from that you loved, it's the home that you're in right now that's changing, right? That you're losing. Happy. Okay. So I wanted to share with you four of the interesting facts and concepts I came across. The one is that people are using euphemisms, and I just heard this yesterday, like the new normal. How many of you have heard that? People talk about that? Yeah. A man in my driveway yesterday said, yeah, it's just the new normal. It's fine. And so we can't even say the word abnormal to each other because it reminds us of what we're losing. So that's number one. Number two is that surveys are showing that it's young people who are experiencing this the most, and that high degrees of fear and worry and anxiety.
And the thing about a new normal is actually it's not normal, but we can't say and acknowledge that it's not normal. So we make up another term to say it's a new normal.
Right. So we can still smile. Okay. Number three out of four is, I found this interesting, that the most of the work around adaptation around climate change has been on like technological changes and how we're going to adapt to our environment. And very little has been done on the adaptive capacity of the individuals and what we're going to have to do emotionally. And number four, I found this very interesting. I'm just going to read this too because it's easier. Slower. I'll slow down. Okay. Ecological mourning is another phrase that's being used a lot, is complicated because although we care about what we've lost or stand to lose in the future, we're also complicit in the loss, right? Ecological mourning and grieving are often accompanied by guilt, shame, and a sense of failure. Ecological losses are in many instances, incomprehensible because the numbers are so large, right, as to be unthinkable. For example, the number of species going extinct. Right? You all heard about that, a million species on the brink. And in some cases, the loss hasn't yet happened, so we're engaged in anticipatory grieving, right, which is, I think, where I am. And at the same time, while we're grieving, we're still participating in the very practices that are driving the losses. So it's very complex. And for many people, the scale of the grief is so vast, and I know other people share this, that we fear drowning in it if we dare open the floodgates, right? And so we find it easier to keep our grief dammed behind a wall of denial. So solutions, this is a newer concept, but one of the people talking about this is saying that we're going to need to change our story, right? How we see ourselves and the earth and our connection to it, because when our story changes and our values change, and then we live more lightly on the earth. So that's one thing. And the other thing is, final thing, and I'm not sure what's going on in Toronto. I couldn't find anything specific to Toronto, but there are a lot of support groups now popping up for this. So people are meeting. One group's called Good Grief, and has members ranging from millennials to grandparents, and they sit and they talk about what's happening. University courses on environmental change are starting to incorporate this because they found their students were becoming so depressed that they were not able to complete the course. So now there are classes being added, lessons being added to cope with the emotional piece of it. And thirdly, in the vein of the 12-step program, people are creating what they've called 9-step programs. One woman has created a 9-step program. And, of course, the first thing is admit there's a problem. So I figured, you know, like, because I'm experiencing this, I thought I would share it with you. I just found it all very interesting. But also, you know, if Game of Thrones has counselors because of the grief of losing a TV show, that, you know, maybe it's time we sort of think about the emotional side of this and not just sort of the recycling and the, you know, using less water, but also starting to recognize, like, this is you know, it's an emotional issue as well. It's a psychological issue as well as a practical issue. So I offer that as wisdom for the journey. Maybe walk in its light.
I think Deb would be the first to say that we all have different ways of feeling that, and some are expressive and others are like Deb, who you can't tell what she's feeling about things. No, we all have different ways of feeling that, and they're all legitimate. If you could turn to the next slide, Peter. I chose as a background bamboo. I have been told, but I have not experienced this, that if you stand very still in a bamboo grove and pick a sprout, you can watch it grow if you have the time to stand there, because they sometimes grow 2 feet per day. 2 feet per day. So if you have a day to watch that, the reason I mention them is they are becoming one of the most helpful plants. They always have been in cultures. They've been used for building where you live, what you live in, what you work with, what you eat out of, what you eat. It is one of the most useful things. And the nice thing about it is it's replenishable easily. You can grow it anywhere. I have several books on bamboo, but I have one for growing them in temperate climates. So they're even used to some cold and some frost. We don't qualify. We're too far north. But there's lots of places that can grow this, and they're beautiful. I don't know if you've ever stood in a bamboo grove in a breeze and heard the leaves and then the culms. The culms are the stems, as it were, the culms cracking against each other. It is beautiful music. So one thing I was thinking of, the grounded in the interconnectedness of life. There are two kinds. There are pachymorphs and there are leptomorphs. Some of you knew that. And the pachymorphs they call clumping bamboos, and you can risk putting them in a small garden because they stay pretty much together. And the leptomorph leptomeres, sorry, are they call them either spreading or invasive. So you don't put them in a small garden or you'll be treating them as weeds and they'll spread. And the reason I'm raising this is that was two ways of putting those two things. We're grounded because of our connectedness. We choose to be guided by love because we're connected. Since we're connected, we choose to connect lovingly. And because we need to do it better, we need to grow in wisdom. And the two emphases, I love that the pachymeres are close together. They're connected together. Unless you want them to not be so close, and then they're called clumping. So it depends on what you want at the time. If you want them close together, or clumping doesn't sound as good. So when we are growing together, we need to be together, but not so clumped together that we aren't individuals. And then the leptomorphs that leap away, they're either called spreading because we want them to spread, or they're called invasive because they're spreading where you don't want them to. And so in that, as we go out into the world, we go out either connected and loving or invading, and that's not what we want. I love the whole image of what bamboo is, gives to us, grounded in the connectedness, choosing to love because we're connected, and getting better at it together because we're connected.
We have three readings this morning. The first is by Washington Irving, an American author, essayist, and biographer. Perhaps there never was a monument more characteristic of an age and people than the Alhambra, a rugged fortress without a voluptuous palace within, war frowning from its battlements, poetry breathing throughout the fairy architecture of its halls. The second reading is by Jean Vanier. Each person, with his or her history of being accepted or rejected, with his or her past history of inner pain and difficulties in relationships with parents, is different. But in each one, there is a yearning for communion and belonging, but at the same time, a fear of it. Love is what we want, yet it is what we fear the most. Love makes us vulnerable and open, but then we can be hurt through rejection and separation. We may crave for love, but then be frightened of losing our liberty and creativity. We want to belong to a group, but we fear a certain death in the group because we may not be seen as unique. We want love, but fear the dependence and commitment it implies. We fear being used, manipulated, smothered, and spoiled. We are all so ambivalent toward love, communion, and belonging. And her final reading is by Lucy Hughes Hallett, an award-winning British cultural historian. They saw how the wall around Eden stretched away on either hand, with only one opening, as though to guard those within from hungry hordes who might wish to come inside. And next to the cherubim, they saw the flaming sword. The flaming sword turned this way to prevent any intruder entering from the east, and that way to prevent any intruder entering from the west. But it did not ever turn in the direction of the garden. The mouse and the beetle stood together watching it for a long time. Beyond it, the country stretched away, with winding rivers and low hills and stands of trees and no moving thing in sight. The beetle said, "These are formidable defenses. No one can enter Eden. But I do not see that there is anything to prevent us leaving." Offered his wisdom for the journey.
Excuse me? C- calling you home. Which is actually the first line of the focus moment. You call out as you enter the house, "It's just me." And the person to whom you call assurance turns her head back to her task, completely unaware that in the click of the door latch closing, unknown powers, unseen skills, unfamiliar possibilities, all these and more are now closed in with her, filling her private space. She could not know that fear was welcomed, that it whispers constant threats inside your mind, nor secrets buried deeply and locked away, the possibility of their ever coming out managed carefully below your daily confidence. Her imagination did not turn to the trauma or tragedy, those stories never shared, but close, close, too close to the surface on any given day. The idea that you should go away and not for just a little while, the worst one of all, would break her heart. So you call up again. "Shall I make us a cuppa?" And the atmosphere shimmers into ease, your truths for today. Lie down and wait. I forgot my papers at home, and this week I forgot everything but the last page. So this could be the perspectives that never ends. I'll just keep going. But the readings that I pulled together this week were focused on the theme, "A mighty fortress is our mind or our brain," because the mighty fortress was a sort of look at what was happening in the passages that I read that prepare me each Sunday for what it is that I'm going to share. And out of them, I pulled the idea that whatever it is that we are facing at any given time, we respond to it with the tools that we have already collected, with what's already in our brain, with the behaviors and the reactions and the ideas of what we expect to happen, prepared to come out, particularly in a crisis, that we are hardwired, our brains are hardwired, and that as we go about our everyday, as we enter into a conversation, as we move amongst a crowd of unknown people, as we step out on the curb, from the curb and see things are not quite the way they should be, and so we step back, our brains are doing what they're supposed to do. They're constantly telling us, reminding us, moving us in split-second ways that we're totally unaware of that save our lives over and over and over every day. I used to refer to the first 2 or 3 years of parenting as 24-hour suicide prevention because your kids don't have those things in their brains when they need them. And so you're constantly running to grab them from falling down the stairs or jumping in the swimming pool or, you know, climbing the escalator, getting on the escalator, going the wrong way or something. They're constantly at your wit's end sometimes trying to keep them from losing their lives because they're just not protected in the way that they are. Our brains are beautiful things. And the Alhambra reading from Washington Irving's book was a beautiful way of describing what the brain is. He was given permission to go into the Alhambra Palace in Spain when he was writing a book at the early part of the 20th century and was amazed at what was in that place that reflected the time and the stories of when it had been built and the people who had built it. And as he wrote his book, he felt he could never really do it justice, right? And that works as a metaphor, too, because none of us could ever really do justice to describing what our brains are or what we think or what we believe or the connections with people that we have. None of us, I mean, I couldn't remember the names of the women who were at the around the table on Thursday night. So another person collaborated with me and we still couldn't put them all together, right? So we don't, our ability to just say, oh, this is what's on my mind and put it all out would be almost impossible. But Irving's reading, which I don't have in front of me, Irving's reading brings these beautiful things together. The idea that it is a fortress, that it looks like something that's imposing and frightening from the outside, that on its ramparts are things that suggest that if you come close, we're going to blow your brains out or something like that. It's got this fierceness to it. But inside, he says it's a voluptuous palace. And our brains, sometimes, particularly if you're, you know, constantly on the alert for an argument or sharing your knowledge or something, people see you as, oh, wow, that person knows so much more than me, and so I'm not going to get into a conversation with them, and you back away. That's the fortress mentality thing going on. But inside, there is this, like, poetic beauty that Irving brings out in his book. And so we recognize that our brains aren't just that fortress with everything locked in it, but they're also these beautiful this poetry. I like the idea of the fairy architecture of its halls. Have any of you seen anything online that shows imaging more of a video than just a static picture of the neurons, a recreation of what neurons in the brain look like as we think? It's like fairy architecture. And it's just this light going off and on, close and distant. It's quite beautiful. And so that fairy architecture of the brain is another piece of the way that the Alhambra Palace seemed to speak to what our brains are like. So with all that beauty in between our ears and all of it history, our brains are history. They're like the Alhambra Palace, they're history. They reflect a time and a place that it was built. And I'm not talking in utero. I'm saying that the parts of our brain that respond and react to things, the things that we know about ourselves, the things that we know about each other, our likes and dislikes, the foods that we will happily put on our plates at a buffet, and the ones that we'll just walk by and not look at, all of that's history. The colors that we're drawn to, the scents that we like, all of that's history. Might be a little bit that's DNA. I don't think I've told you yet. Did I tell you my roots, how deep my roots are? 98th percentile when it comes to Neanderthal genes. That's history. But some of those things might be genetic, like I'm supposed to be able to hit a note if you give it to me. That's a genetic thing. But the kind of music I like may or may not be genetic, right? So it's all history. I like the music I grew up with. You like the music you grew up with. We like the music that Scott plays because it fits our hearts in a certain way. Our brains are history. And so they're a very good thing in that we can rely upon them for things like stepping off the curb and for calling someone up because we know who they are and they're going to take our call, and writing a letter to someone, sharing them thoughts and getting a response back and how that feels and provides a new opportunity. We have all of that wired into our head. And we have how we live with that wired into our head too, whether as in the focus moments, it's something that you keep buried so that others don't see or know it, or whether it's something that you risk bringing out and wanting to see, engage the person and how they would react to it. Our brains are like that too. The Jean Vanier reading talks about who we are and what kind of people we are and that history, that it comes from the past. And the way that we live and the way that we act comes from our past. But we often don't, we often assume that the people that we happen to be standing with at the bus stop or in the grocery lineup with, people that we don't really know, we don't assume that they might have some kind of trauma in their life that they're trying to cope with. We don't assume that they've got three hungry kids at home. We don't assume that those three kids are there only on a temporary visit with your partner who's in the house because of violence that has happened before. We don't assume that someone doesn't have enough money to pay for the bus home, so is going to have to carry all the groceries. We don't assume that people have jobs. We assume, this is the Vanna White syndrome, we assume that everybody is just like us. That everybody we meet has the same ideas and thoughts, that we don't have to tell them anything because they'll understand us until they prove us differently. And once they prove us differently, it's kind of like, okay, won't walk into that one again. Or, oh, really? Tell me more about that. And we find things out about people once we step beyond that place of things being the same. We have to step into vulnerability in order to find out that the person next to you is not exactly like you, right? We would prefer to think that they're just like me and then I'm safe, right? But they often aren't. And so we end up missing opportunities to engage that we could have. One of the things that I've been doing in my meditation and the opportunity to stay well, the chances of staying well around some of the things that Scott talked about and much of what Deb talked about, and put those two things together, and there are good days, and you see good days, because Sunday is always a good day. Regardless of what kind of a day Sunday is, it's going to be a good day. But there are other days that are stunningly not good days, and you don't see those days, and we don't bring them in here. But there's a piece of in a meditation, which is from a poet, monk, that has been really helpful in my trying to understand sort of where I am now and why all that happened and why it's still happening the way it's happening. And it's a poem. It's a little rubric. And I think I shared some of it with you a couple of weeks ago. I have arrived. I am home. In the here and now. I am solid. I am free. In the ultimate, I dwell. And I never resonated with that kind of language before. Like, I reside in the ultimate. Well, what on earth does that mean, that I reside in the ultimate? Until I dug into it with the help of this teacher on the meditation app that I use, which invited me to see the ultimate as a time and space-oriented reality. And ultimate is the final thing, right? The last, most recent, final thing. The penultimate is the second last. And I don't know if there's a triumph ultimate, probably, but you go back. The ultimate is the pinnacle, right? So if we are standing here now, every single one of us is now in the ultimate moment of your life. And now you're in an ultimate moment, and now you're in an ultimate moment, and now you're in an ultimate moment, and it carries on. And every moment that goes past is a past moment. But the reality around that is that we rarely live in the ultimate moment because we're usually worrying about something that's going to happen in the future that we may or may not be prepared for. Or we're feeling regret, or we're living in memories of joy, or we're thinking about something that happened in the past. And the challenge about life is that the present, we can only think in the present, and we spend most of our thinking time in the future or the past. So we miss the present almost all the time. We miss the ultimate almost all the time. The other thing that that it taught me as we were going through the meditation and the reflections on it was that sense of everything happens for a reason, or everything happened for a reason. Do you know that? How many of you know that? You've heard that. We've all heard that. And I have been so pissed at that statement for so long, because I can't accept that there's some reason, you know, that has made this thing happen, particularly if it's a horrific thing. But it was presented in a different way. And it was presented as nothing else could have happened in that place and time other than what happened. And that's different from everything happens for a reason. That thing that happens there is the engagement of every life story that came to that moment, your life story that came to that moment, and what you bring into a place and what everyone else brings into the place makes that moment happen, and nothing else could have happened. Either because you didn't have the conversation, or because the tool that might have made it better wasn't there, or because the person who would have drawn out the best conversation, the better one than the one you really had, wasn't present, or because no one heard what you said, because no one in that group had ever heard what you said, and the chance of them actually hearing you that moment was like nil. So what happened was the only thing that could happen in that moment. And that was a freeing thought. That allowed me to walk away from a lot of the pain and anger that was in my heart around not just the stuff going on in the church, but a whole lot of family stuff, a whole lot of history, because the way things happened could only have happened as they did. Jean Vanier did some writing in another book that I wanted to bring to you too, and that's the page that's missing, so I'm not going to talk about that. He was talking about how there are three different ways that that things come to be in terms of an interaction, a relationship, and that is, and they're all difficult, but they're always all there, and we have to wrestle them into submission. And there are things like believing that the other party doesn't have the right to be there, that they're intruding on something that is not theirs, and we need to put them back into place. Another one is that we are the ones with all of the authority. And so we are the ones who make the decision. And those people, we don't ask them for their opinion, because they don't deserve our attention and they shouldn't be part of the narrative. And they're around those kinds of things. But when we move into this idea that everything that has happened because of the confluence of the realities at that moment in time, and so we can imagine for ourselves something different, because here we are in our ultimate moment, and here we are again in our ultimate moment, and we can make choices in that ultimate moment that create a different reality going forward than what we might expect, then we have the opportunity to grow. And that growth is never easy. So I'm going to step away from that now and go to this. Can you put my mic? Because I was singing too loud. Thank you. So what I really wanted to say today is a simple thing that many of us know. And that is that the neural pathways in our brains are well-worn. The neural pathways that allowed me to speak Korean, I have not worn well, and so I have no ability to speak Korean. Never ever used those pathways. I have pathways to use English pretty well, so those pathways are there. I could lose them, and aphasia is something that happens when people have dementia, and that's losing those neural pathways, and so they use words that are inappropriate. Not inappropriate, they're just the wrong words when they come out. And my neural pathways for singing have been much improved this year because I've been in the choir, so I've sung more this year than I have ever before, though. When Peter's going to play The Police, Every Breath I Take is going to sing us out, and I could probably nail that one a few years ago. But the neural pathways in our brain are very strong. And so that's the main reason that our brains are a fortress, because we can't figure any other way to get out of them than the way that is really well-worn. And so we act in the same ways, we do the same things, we say the same stuff, we get angry with the same people, we have that same triggering conversation that sends everybody to the other sides of the wall or the house or whatever. We do things that we know well. We reach for drinks that we shouldn't reach for. We reach for foods that we shouldn't take in. We avoid animals that might actually give us some sense of peace and love, but we've got this neural pathway that says I'm afraid of them, or I'm afraid of that, and I can't go near it. It's spiders for me. You can't go near a spider. All of those things are in our brains, and we can't change unless we do the work of trying to change that neural pathway. Many of you know that a couple of years ago, my son and I were not able to talk to each other. I was so ridden with anxiety around that relationship that I couldn't see him and breathe at the same time. And so we didn't see each other for over a year. And then my therapist took me through an emotional freedom technique, tapping. Have any of you heard of that? So you talk about just because, or although this is the reality, although I experience incredible anxiety when I think about my son, I can't go to see him, you know, although all of that stuff, and you're tapping on the butt of your hand while you're doing that. And then the theory is that there's these meridians in your body that you can reprogram by tapping on certain places in your head. And there's also, I mean, recently, the most recent article I read, not about that, but there are ways that we can change ourselves that are not medical, right? So they've recently shown that tones at 40 hertz and lights at 40 hertz, flashing at 40 hertz, can prevent or reverse dementia. So there's things that happen. So these meridians, these tapping meridians, I did this with my therapist in her office, and all that anxiety was gone, absolutely gone. Deb, I can remember Deb sending me a text saying, how are you feeling about seeing Isaac? And I checked for a long time. Nothing. I'm fine. And I'd done this thing once in her office. So it's so good, I try it again. And I get going on about it again, and I do it, and about another situation in my life, and absolutely nothing happened. Nothing. It made no difference at all. And I thought, well, that was obviously the placebo effect, right? I really wanted it to work, so it worked. And I, you know, honestly, I'm happy to be the recipient of the placebo event, you know, in any situation. You know, if it's going to work, I'm happy to let it work. But then I started remembering this stuff about the brain and the neural pathways. And yeah, I'd only been anxious about my son for a few months. You know, it hadn't been something, a neural pathway that was that old. And so I'm going back now to some of those deeper neural pathways and seeing if I can change them and finish them off. And I think we have to have the courage to do that. We have to have the courage, not necessarily the emotional freedom technique tapping thing, but we have to have the courage to feel ourselves doing what we always do and reminding ourselves, how many times have I said I want to stop that? And doing the stop. And then keeping track of the stop. I have a little habit journal that I track things. Okay, I did this today. Yes, that's the thing I want to do. No, I didn't do this thing today. That's the thing I want to avoid. Because my brain is going to drive me crazy. Right? I think you all know that, right? It's news to me. But I think we have to find ways to overcome our impulses and find our ways into a new way of being with ourselves that results in a new way of our being with one another. So I invite you to go home and challenge your neural pathways. Maybe write down 3 or 4 things that you do automatically that you wish you didn't, and make up a little journal to say, okay, I'm not going to do that. You know, every time I go to the mall, I skip from one store to the other, and people seem to be upset about that, so I'm not going to skip anymore. Or, you know, whatever it might be that you do, to see how hard it is without paying attention to make change. Change only happens when we pay attention, and it only happens when we really work to make it work. Thank you. Did you notice Scott played different chords there? I knew what he was doing. Trying to override those neural pathways. Thank you for that object lesson. We go out into a world that expects exactly who we are, who we were when we came into this place, who we were the last time we talked to whoever we talk to next. They expect us to be exactly that person. And that might work for you. It may be that you can't actually be honest with the next person you talk to. And that's a good choice if you can't do that. But when you know that there is work that might be done, or when you know that there's something that needs to be shared, or when you know that not honoring whatever the truth is that's in you needs to find a way, a planned and appropriate way to be shared, then we need to do that work. And so I invite you to that task. To seeing the change you can be and making it happen with the loving support of a whole room full of people who are also going to be struggling with the same thing. So go from this place in peace.
Listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to www.westhill.net/donate.